Human achievement has brought us much to marvel at in this modern age. The internet, space travel, overnight delivery service, but the wheels of progress have not always turned smoothly. In fact, the history of mankind has been, if nothing else, a bumpy ride. People are people, after all, no matter the era in which they lived, and the tendency to error is perhaps the one constant. Yet it's this flawed existence that propels us forward through the moments of shock, awe, anguish, and above all, hope that we will do better. This is your host, Danny, and this is the first episode in our series, Shocking Events That Made History. In our first episode, we will focus on shocking events that have to do with big ideas that turned out to be not so big, or actually something wrong happened. Well, big ideas like what? Well, for starters, we'll talk about the telephone, Western Union turning down Alexander Graham Bell trying to sell them the patent for the telephone for only $100,000. Thinking that it is a stupid idea, can you imagine? And the rest of the events we're going to talk about are just like that, if not even more shocking. So stay with me, stay tuned, and we're going to start talking about some of the most shocking events that made history. Now, before I start with those big ideas, those shocking moments, let me just give you a little bit of an introduction of the whole series so that you know what we're going to talk about throughout the whole series. We're going to have a sampling of twists and turns in the human experience, from backfiring innovations to political conflicts. We will cast light on the less than stellar moments when astonishing potential has been buried beneath blunder and brilliance left gasping for breath. Galileo didn't merely look to the heavens and observe that Earth revolved around the sun. He suffered mightily for his discovery, condemned by religious authorities who insisted the opposite was true. Similarly, just as Leonardo created a masterpiece in the Mona Lisa, some fool found a way to steal it. And while Lincoln may have been one of the greatest presidents in American history, four losers in a row, Zachary Taylor, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan, immediately preceded him, a veritable Mount Rushmore of mediocrity. In this historical perspective, giants like George Washington and the unflinchingly cruel likes of Caligula share the stage. The realm of great cultural milestones, including the Venus de Milo and the works of Shakespeare, is crowded with entertainment from P.T. Barnum, Jerry Springer, and the Kardashians. With a wonderful perspective of time, some troubled moments become laughable, all ill-advised ad campaign, a blown investment opportunity now worth billions, attempts at a teetotal America, other failings leave a more painful imprint, religious persecution, political fighting, treachery. Not all is negative, however. Despite our most egregious follies, we humans do have the capacity to learn from our mistakes. Even if it does sometimes take us a while, history is a vast early warning system, Norman Cousins once wrote. There's always another chance to take heed. So, are you interested yet? I guess you are. You should be interested because we're going to talk about all these great things in the series, and we will start talking about big ideas. The world's longest suspension bridge, corporate behemoths joining forces, a revolutionary vaccine. Progress starts with an idea, but it doesn't always move forward as planned. From the biggest embarrassments in the financial business to the shortest-sighted scientific breakthroughs, these are moments, some blundering, some downright disastrous, that have shaped our journey into the modern era. While time is the great judge of success or failure, these thwarted efforts have something to tell us all. So now, let the journey begin, and let's start our journey with Western Union's bad call on the telephone. That's coming next. Western Union was the communications behemoth in the years following the Civil War. The nervous system of commerce, as William Orton, president of the mighty telegraph company, once crowed. Supremely confident in its status as one of the world's richest and most powerful companies, Western Union dismissed the recently patented telephone as a toy. when in 1876, Alexander Graham Bell and his associates offered to sell it outright for $100,000. And here I quote, "The idea is idiotic on the face of it." And that is quoted from an internal Western Union memo. And it goes on to say, "Furthermore, why would any person want to use this ungainly and impractical device when he can send a messenger to the telegraph office and have a clear written message sent to any large city in the United States?" End quote. The rejection stung. But as Bell's assistant Thomas Watson later noted, it turned out to be another piece of good fortune for us all. 2 years later, those same patents could not have been bought for $25 million. Watson was right. As Western Union quickly came to realize and regret, in a gesture of bad sportsmanship, the company tried to challenge Bell's patent by joining forces with Elisha Gray, the loser in an earlier telephone patent race with Bell, and even Thomas Edison, who had made some significant improvements on the telephone transmitter. Together, they claimed Bell had, in essence, stolen the idea for the telephone and began marketing their own system. And here I quote what Bell lamented in a letter to his wife. He said, "The more fame a man gets for an invention, the more does he become a target for the world to shoot at." The inventor was so disgusted by the whole ugly business that he was ready to walk away. However, the partners with whom he formed the Bell Telephone Company refused to concede. They sued Western Union for patent violations and eventually persuaded Bell to join the battle. His preliminary statement to the court was filed just in time, and he went on to serve as a remarkably effective witness. Western Union never stood a chance. On November the 10th, 1879, the company agreed to withdraw from the telephone business altogether. Today, it limps along as a wire transfer and money order business. The patent issued to Bell, on the other hand, emerged as one of the most valuable in U.S. history. Western Union might take some comfort in the knowledge that its devotion to written messages was in some way validated on December the 3rd, 1992, when the world's first text message was sent. Whether this modern form of the telegram qualifies as a clear written message is debatable, but there can be little argument that it is vastly more popular than phone talking, at least for those under 30. So, that was our very first shocking event. I don't know if you've heard of it before, or I don't know if you've heard of it with all those juicy details, but that's our first event. And now, let's move on and talk about the second event, and that is the auto industry's first big fail. That's coming next. Don't go away. So, what was that auto industry's first big fail? In the great American marketplace, some ultra-hyped products are bound to fizzle. New Coke, celery-flavored Jell-O, McDonald's Mac Pizza. But the most spectacular failure of a new product was without a doubt the Ford Edsel. Eager to make a splash in a competitive auto market, Ford Motor Company bombarded the public with ads touting the Edsel as the car of the future. But they never actually showed it. The grand unveiling E-Day, as Ford called it, was on September the 4th, 1957. Instead of gasps of awe, though, there were snickers. The mysterious Edsel's most prominent feature was an enormous vertical front grille. Engineers had discovered that the innovation had to be enlarged to suck in enough air to cool the engine. Worse, the Edsel was plagued with problems like peeling paint, doors that failed to close, and a faulty push-button transmission. Ford put the car out of its misery in 1959, but strangely enough, it is now a highly sought-after collector's item. So, that was the auto industry's first big fail. And now let's talk about the Titanic wreck of hubris. What was that? Of course, we're talking about the Titanic sinking, right? Now, J. Bruce Ismay may have survived the Titanic sinking, but his reputation didn't. He hopped in a lifeboat while most men on board, including the captain, went down with the ship. On April the 18th, 1912, Ismay stepped off the rescue liner Carpathia with the other 705 surviving passengers, mostly women and children. Almost immediately, the press assault began. the chairman and managing director of the White Star Line, was the most reviled man in the world, excoriated not only as a coward, but also as the architect of the disaster for failing to furnish the ship with enough lifeboats, and for having allegedly ordered the Titanic's captain to accelerate to reach New York faster. Subsequent inquiries found no proof of such accusations, but Ismay's very survival condemned him. The foundering of his reputation, along with the ship that White Star had heralded as unsinkable, was a devastating crack in the human hubris that had buoyed technological progress. And as shocking as this was, we're going to talk next about America's favorite pilot takes a dive. And here, of course, we're talking about Charles Lindbergh. So don't go away. Stay tuned. We're going to continue our shocking events that made history with America's favorite pilot takes a dive. That's coming next. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly when Charles Lindbergh went from public hero number one, great trailblazer of American air travel, to public enemy number one, with his notions about racial purity and the isolationism he advocated for America as Hitler rampaged through Europe. The one-time idol managed to alienate his adoring public and spiral into disgrace. A decade after he soloed the Spirit of St. Louis over the Atlantic to become an instant hero in 1927, Lindbergh made several trips to Nazi Germany. There, he extolled the German Luftwaffe's strength and praised Hitler's leadership. Then on October the 19th, 1938, he accepted, by order of the Führer, the Service Cross of the Order of the German Eagle. American critics bristled. Lindbergh rejected the notion of returning the medal, writing that it would be an unnecessary insult. Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes noted vehemently he had no hesitation about sending back to the president his commission in the United States Army Air Corps Reserve in 1941, but he still hangs on to the Nazi medal. The nadir of Lindbergh's public career came during a speech delivered on September 11, 1941, in which he condemned the British, the Jewish people, and the Roosevelt administration. The public reacted immediately. Lindbergh faced what biographer Scott Berg described as a Niagara of invective. Few men in American history had ever been so reviled. The lone eagle had fallen. And now let's talk about something else. Let's talk about American engineering feats that almost weren't. And what are we talking about here? Stay with me. Some of the most ambitious pursuits of modern architecture were wrought with potential catastrophe. The Brooklyn Bridge, or the Eighth Wonder of the World, as it was once called, stands today, against all odds, as an enduring monument. The 19th century symbol of aspiration and ingenuity was raised despite the far less respectable designs of one corrupt character. On January the 11th, 1877, the bridge's Board of Trustees awarded J. Lloyd Hay the contract to provide the critical steel wiring that would support the mile-plus span. Chief Engineer Washington Rubling had repeatedly warned the board that Hay couldn't be trusted, but his bid had been championed by board member and future New York Mayor Abram S. Hewitt, who held a mortgage on Hay's steel mill. As a result of the lucrative cable contract, he would be assured steady monthly payments. Hay was in a position to perpetuate a massive fraud, one that could have fatally undermined the impressive structure in an era when suspension bridges routinely failed. And Rubling, previously debilitated by decompression sickness while working on the bridge's foundations, wasn't there to stop him. The deception, once discovered, was painfully simple, historian David McCullough wrote. Hay had a certain amount of high-quality steel wiring on hand, which he presented for inspection at this mill, but the approved wiring was diverted on the way to the construction site and replaced with inferior wire that was then applied to the bridge. Fortunately, the design specifications for the bridge called for far more cable support than was necessary for the span, so Hay's inferior steel didn't have to be replaced, a nearly impossible undertaking anyway. Nearly a century later, another bold engineering project caused trouble on the East Coast. Boston's John Hancock Tower could have ended in disaster, but this time as a result of bad planning rather than corruption. It all began in the basement where three sides of the excavation caved inward. The completed structure made its occupants seasick, swaying back and forth and twisting even in ordinary wind conditions. Equally unsettling was a series of falling window panes, including giant 500-pound panels of mirrored glass that crashed down in 1973. Soon, more than an acre of the gleaming building was pocked with black-painted plywood. In 1975, the tower's owners were warned of the most daunting prospect of all. The building was in danger of actually tipping. Luckily, there was just enough room in the building's service core to install 1,500 tons of reinforcing steel braces, and the iconic office building has now been standing strong for decades. Well, do you think that was shocking? Wait till you listen to the other events as well, because I promise you the other events are as shocking as the events I just mentioned. And next, I'm going to tell you about one of the biggest mergers in history. Or was it? That's coming next. Don't go away. So what is this all about? AOL plus Time Warner, you've got FAIL. It was the largest corporate merger in history, reported in the business press as breathlessly as a royal wedding. On January the 10th, 2000, it was announced that AOL, the nation's dominant internet provider, was to unite with communications giant Time Warner to form a seemingly perfect consolidation of old and emerging media. And here let me quote Ted Turner himself. "Shortly before 9 last night, I had the honor and privilege of signing a piece of paper that irrevocably cast a vote for this merger." End quote. And that's Ted Turner, a Time Warner director. And he continues by saying, "I did it with as much or more excitement and enthusiasm as I did on that night when I first made love some 42 years ago." End quote. Nothing less than astonishing, right? What followed can only be likened to the regret of the next morning hangover. AOL's stock price was soaring, but there were hidden warts. The Washington Post discovered the company had been inflating its advertising revenue. The Securities and Exchange Commission and the Justice Department conducted subsequent investigations that resulted in hefty fines. Plus, the merger coincided with the bursting of the tech bubble. In the following years, many employees lost their jobs or the bulk of their retirement funds. Turner, the combined company's largest stockholder, lost 80% of his net worth, or about $8 billion. The royal wedding of mergers ended in a sour, costly divorce. And since we're talking about mergers, let's continue on and talk about Wall Street and what happened in September 15th, 2008. And that was Wall Street's wake-up call. Lehman Brothers CEO Dick Fuld expected his employees to be the best-dressed people on Wall Street. Appearances mattered. Yet below that natty exterior, there was rot. Lehman's lending practices and risky real estate ventures had pushed Fuld's kingdom to the brink of collapse. In the face of disaster, the cocksure CEO dismissed offers to buy Lehman assets that might have saved the company. On September 15, 2008, Lehman Brothers was forced into bankruptcy, the largest in American history, with $613 billion in debts outstanding. "I feel like I want to throw up," Fuld said at the time, a sentiment doubtless shared by the 26,000 Lehman employees who, after months of reassurances, lost their jobs and their company stock. "People want his head," one employee said. "So did the entire nation. The firm's collapse helped precipitate a global financial meltdown." So you can never tell what lies beneath those good looks. I'm not saying everybody, of course, but some people, they know themselves. And obviously, there's a lot of rot hiding beneath those luxury suits. But anyway, that's what happened in Wall Street in 2008. Now let's move on to talk about something else. What is that about? Well, this is about someone bailed out into the lap of luxury. Well, let's talk about that. You must have heard of it. It didn't happen a long time ago. It just happened in September 23, 2008. What to do with an $85 billion government bailout? A few days after avoiding total financial ruin, executives of insurance giant AIG breathed a sigh of relief and headed off on September the 23rd, 2008 to de-stress for a week at a luxury resort in Monarch Beach, California. The bill was $443,343.71, which included $150,000 for banquets, $10,000 in bar bills, $7,000 in greens fees, $23,000 at the hotel spa, and $1,400 at the salon. They were getting their manicures while the American people were paying their bills, thundered the representative Elijah E. Cummings during a hearing in the aftermath. The chastened executives canceled another planned retreat to the Ritz-Carlton Spa Resort at California's Half Moon Bay, but they still got their bonuses and an additional $37.8 billion in bailout money in the midst of the biggest recession since the Great Depression. What a shame. But it happens. And unfortunately, it keeps happening. But anyway, we're talking about shocking events that made history, and that's what you're here to listen to, right? And that's one of them. Definitely one of them. And now, let's go next to something that has to do with shoes. And we're going to talk about the stinkiest sneaker ad in history. That's coming next. Don't go away. By 1999, Birmingham, Alabama-based shoe retailer Just for Feet had superstores across the United States and was eager to update its image. What better way than to run a spectacular commercial during the Super Bowl? The cost was exorbitant, but the exposure, priceless. Just for Feet took the leap. Instead of coming off as edgy and relevant, though, the spot that ran during the fourth quarter of the big game on January the 31st, 1999, flopped in front of an estimated 127 million television viewers. The ad opened with a shot of what appeared to be four white men in a military Humvee, Just for Feet, on the license plate, tracking a barefoot black runner in Kenya as a lion watched. The pursuers caught up to him and offered him water, laced with some kind of tranquilizer. Upon drinking it, the runner collapsed and the men forced a pair of Nikes on his feet. When the runner came to, he saw the shoes on his feet and began to shout, "No!" He then ran off, trying to shake the shoes from his feet. The backlash from the ad was immediate. "Appallingly insensitive," declared the New York Times. An advertising age reporter called the commercial neo-colonialists, culturally imperialist, and probably racist. Have these people lost their minds? The Des Moines Register suggested Just for Feet be renamed Just for Racists. This was far from the kind of response Just for Feet desired in its first foray into big league advertising. It sued the advertising firm that created the commercial, Saatchi & Saatchi, as a direct consequence of Saatchi's appallingly unacceptable and shockingly unprofessional performance, the complaint read. Just for Feet's favorable reputation has come under attack. Its reputation has suffered. Advertising executive Grant Richards, for one, had little sympathy for either side of the dispute. He told Advertising Age in 2000 that the agency was a fool for proposing such a thing and the client was a fool for paying for it. In the end, Just for Feet's complaint became irrelevant. The company went bankrupt in 1999 and collapsed in the midst of a massive accounting fraud. So some of you might remember the company, some of you might not, but that was one of the shocking events that actually made history. And next, we're going to talk about cigarettes and tobacco selling out for big tobacco. And who are we going to talk about here? Well, actually, we're going to talk about Hollywood A-listers. Hollywood A-listers have long been a surefire means of promotion for cigarettes. Since the late 1930s, such celebrity powerhouses as Clark Gable, Joan Crawford, and Betty Davis endorsed cigarettes by way of testimonials, ads, or sometimes placement in top box office movies. The strategy extended beyond the theater, too. Cartoon icon Fred Flintstone puffed on cigarettes and extolled the virtues of the tobacco brand sponsoring his show. "Winston tastes good," said Fred, "like a cigarette should." Baseball hero Mickey Mantle pitched Viceroy and Camel cigarettes. Research highlighting smoking's negative health effects, however, proved less captivating at first. In fact, star endorsements seemed to surge in profitability even as cigarettes' risk came to light, as seen when Rocky cashed in on the endorsement trend on April 28, 1983. Sylvester Stallone signaled his willingness to contribute to the cause with the following memo addressed to Bob Kovaloff of Associated Film Promotions. And it goes like, "Dear Bob, as discussed, I guarantee that I will use Brown & Williamson tobacco products in no less than 5 feature films. It is my understanding that Brown & Williamson will pay a fee of $500,000, hoping to hear from you soon. Sincerely, Sylvester Stallone." But just, I have to be fair here. Things change. You know, tobacco was okay, cigarettes was okay back then, and that's why they made those deals. But I'm just talking about those deals that were still being made even after the dangers of tobacco came to light. But that's something controversial, and I'm not saying that these people are evil or not. I'm just saying that some people would do anything for the right price. So that would be the last event in today's episode. Next time, we're going to continue talking about those big ideas before we move on and talk about some other kind of shocking events later in the series. Today, we covered a lot of ground. We talked about Western Union's bad call on the telephone. We talked about the auto industry's first big fail. We talked about the Titanic wreck of hubris. We talked about America's favorite pilot takes a dive. We talked about American engineering feats that almost weren't. We talked about that big merger that was actually one of the worst mergers in history, as it turned out, between AOL and Time Warner. We talked about Wall Street's wake-up call, bailed out into the lap of luxury. And here we're talking about the insurance giant AIG. We talked about the stinkiest sneaker ad in history, when Just for Feet turned out to be just for racists. And finally, we talked about selling out for big tobacco companies, and especially we talked about Hollywood A-listers. With that being said, this is your host, Danny. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you next time.